Checking in once again with State Representative Jackie Chan of Quincy here on our first podcast of August 2025, Jackie.
Hey, yeah, happy August, everyone. As you can tell, I'm home today, and it's been quite a weekend this week. So on a National Conference State Legislator stuff, it's been quite a week. And one of the things about particularly when you're this close to Boston as a rep, and you go to a conference like these, is that you're not actually enjoying the conference because you had actually scheduled work during this time period because you knew you're going to be here anyway. So despite what people may think, you're actually going to a conference out of state is actually easier to you benefit to enjoy all the conference benefits than actually being like 10 miles from the conference, which is in Quincy downtown. So I did not get to partake fully of the conference fun, nor did I get to all the conference seminars because we had like scheduled work, for example, on Tuesday, where we had a full slate of schedules. So because I was here anyway, people from out of state were wanting the opportunity to see me about committee stuff. And yeah, so that's kind of how this works. I need to go to a conference outside of Massachusetts.
That's right. Get away from work. But I guess the biggest headline, if you will, is the fact that legislators from Texas were here in Massachusetts this week.
It's not a new event. I mean, we remember the days of Wisconsin when they did like twice. And Texas, I think, has done this before too, Texas Democrats. The Texas legislature has a very interesting situation where they need a supermajority to achieve a quorum, which is why the minority party has a bit of leverage. And you may not be aware, but this is a super part-time legislature where Texas essentially meets, I believe, under 4 months every 2 years. The governor has enormous power because the legislature is never there. When they adjourn, they adjourn. I mean, you can't come back. And they run a 2-year budget, meaning they plan a 2-year fiscal cycle, which means that flexibility is really kind of difficult. Plus, you have the governor running everything. And the only way you come back to the session is the governor comes forces you guys back into sessions, you in case being Texas. They are forced back into session by the governor under the Constitution. They don't actually call session returns themselves. So you're actually dealing with, I would say, a week, but not nearly as powerful as it could be, let's say, in Massachusetts, where we have a full-time legislature, where under the state law, we're required to come back in formal or informal every 72 hours. The committees continue to have hearings and process bills year-round, and you can file bills after the bill filing deadline on the January of the odd number year. So even though you may miss the filing deadline, it doesn't mean you're out of luck. You can still file bills. It just takes slower to process them to get them to committee. So here's a huge disparity for those who, look at state legislatures part-time. Imagine your legislature closing for 2 years after about 4 months, with the only return is the governor brings you back to return. Otherwise, you can't pass any laws, you can't pass any appropriations. You can't make statements, you can't make resolutions, you can't do investigatory oversight committees, you can't do anything. And given the fact that they are out of session and the governor had called him back regarding this redistricting vote, the only leverage the minority party has is to not form a quorum because I believe they need to be a supermajority in the room to have a quorum.
Yeah, in fact, the governor's threatening to have them arrested and brought back. I was curious if you met any of them here in Massachusetts.
No, you may be aware that I talked about this a lot in the past about we're doing this Asian American party on Saturday, this past Saturday night, and then the Asian American and all the other caucuses had their mini caucuses from Friday to Sunday regarding important issues. But we've been informed prior to the party that Texas was wavering on coming in because of the special session. So, to my knowledge, they did not make an appearance this weekend, the Texas delegation. And it's actually interesting that the head of the Democratic caucus in Texas is Chinese.
Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting. I guess.
Representative
I'm sorry.
Wu,
Woo.
WWU. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
So I know the governor did meet with several of them, I believe, at the State House.
Yeah, there's not much to do here. I mean, if you're another state, I mean, one, it gets expensive, right? You're camped out here. I mean, it's not like I run, say, in Massachusetts. So that's going to go deep, dig into the pocketbooks personally for them. And then secondly, I mean, there's an arrest warrant, Texas cops show up, but it's still, believe it or not, extradition situation. The governor of Massachusetts has to be willing to release them if they're arrested here. So, they can do some peculiar things that makes absolutely no sense, to be honest with you, where you could arrest them yourselves and hold them in Massachusetts jail and fight extradition, but that means you have to make something up, or they're gonna have to do something wrong, which is not a good idea, by the way. And then secondly, you could have them just hide out here and make it hard for the state troopers to find them. So, and if the troopers from Texas find them, they're supposed to actually be processed inside a state jail here, and an extradition kicks in, if I remember correctly. It's been a while since I had to do this. We had a constituent issue that, believe it or not, I get a lot of interest in constituent issues. This was actually one case I had to deal with about 8 years ago, 7 years ago or so, where we had to rapidly learn how extradition worked in Massachusetts.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Oh, I get all kinds of constituent cases. People have no clue about just how strange some, or curious, or just different constituent cases we get. And there was an extradition case that came to my office. I had like crash course this thing in like a week.
Right. It's all a learning experience.
Yeah, in case you're wondering, the outcome was that the individual did go back to the state where the crime was committed, in the end.
Okay.
So the governor did not fight extradition.
Okay, I would think in this case, though, she might.
She might. I mean, it's interesting politically how it will play out. And Secretary Galvin did make the best statement. I mean, I know this is all partisan politics and all kinds of like fun, sound bites, but it is, it's a master thief situation where you're not looking, the public isn't looking, your hand goes in and takes from the cookie jar. And that's how corruption works. It's when no one's looking is when people take. And government watchdogs like inspector generals, internal auditing mechanisms, councils, legislatures, boards of selectmen, are supposed to be keeping an eye on the shop, not just on appointed officials, but also appointed officials that watch legislatures. So like the State Ethics Commission, for example, right? You can't be everywhere. We all know this. We're not going to say we're perfect nor we're godlike. But there are mechanisms in place, all over the country, regarding state and local officials to ensure integrity by basically all of us watching each other to make sure we don't do anything wrong. The fear in the federal government, of course, is that you've all heard you've been firing inspector generals everywhere, which means the auditors aren't far behind, which means there's nobody going to be watching the store. And we've become such a partisan situation, especially in DC, is that the party in Congress will to basically allow the executive branch to just rob the place blind if they want to, because of partisan politics. And statistically speaking, the president does a very poor job. A sitting president does a terrible job during midterm elections, campaigning on behalf of their membership. And this kind of interesting false narrative is going on in the Republican Party at the national level. They need Donald Trump's support to win the primary or win a final. Statistically speaking, that's false. I mean, one of the most popular presidents we ever had was FDR. He kept losing every midterm election throughout his, what, 14 years in office, essentially.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he couldn't win a midterm election. He threw money at people. So, while the party remained Democratic, it was an eroding Democratic party during FDR's time. And during wartime presidents, generally speaking, people want stability in Congress, and that turned out to not be true either. So, I mean, I always say that you have to have some confidence in your district to, unfortunately or fortunately, depending who you are, make those hard votes, and your constituency should be understanding and have faith in the job you're doing. But the behavior of Washington Republicans and, guys like Greg Abbott in Texas, seems to indicate that they don't have that strong constituency behind them.
If they're trying to change it to get the majority, yeah, there's out of fear for something, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is the issue of politics, right? A little bit of fear doesn't hurt you. I mean, it's healthy. But if you're in constant fear of your constituency, you're just basically ineffective. Constant fear of constituent makes a very ineffective politician, very ineffective. So, I mean, this is what I see Congress as. And they'll never make truly tough votes that that actually sh should benefit all of us in the end, because good decision making, good information, and listen to everybody to try to get to the solution is the way public policy should work. But we've become so partisan, especially down in DC, which with narrow majority Republicans have in both branches, and a constant fear of the constituency is very troublesome. But Greg Abbott, back to Greg Abbott in Texas for a moment. Actually, I was asked by this by one of the newer reps about whether or not they can change the redistricting mid-cycle. And my response was that districts by constitution are drawn by states, not by the federal government. I suspect that the federal government may want to try to do it themselves down the road, but the constitution pretty much gives the power to redistricting to the states. So there's actually no reason, depending on the state you're in, unless the state constitution says otherwise, that keeps the legislature from redrawing lines. Interesting enough, we actually had a technical correction, in our redistricting this past cycle, where because of COVID and the way the data was collected, and we're under the crunch to get it done on the ballot for voters in 2022, because we had to do it in 2020, 2021, and it had to be on the ballot for 22 for voters to approve. There was some minor errors regarding a couple of lines that threw off a couple of small areas and districts. So technical corrections can happen. We've done it before, after the fact, once the maps were truly finalized and the final census numbers came out. But unless your constitution says otherwise, there's nothing that says a state can't do their census shift. I'm sorry, their district shifts in midterm.
Yeah, it's based on the federal census, though, right? Every 10 years.
Yeah, all the data is still based on the federal census, and the Constitution is pretty plain at this stage, post Civil War, is that every human being in the country is counted regardless of where you're from and your age, as long as you're physically in that state during the period of census count, which is generally beginning of April. You are considered a resident of that state for the purpose of the census. So Massachusetts obviously has a huge influx of students that are here at the beginning of the census count, oddly enough, into the end of the census count because of the fall. And as a result, those students are Massachusetts residents for the sole purpose of the census.
Although I know now the administration actually just today is talking about not including undocumented immigrants in the census for the first time ever.
Yeah, that would be a real tall haul because the Constitution's pretty plain language on this one, and I have a hard time seeing the courts changing it. Also, federal law dictates how the census count works. It's not the president. So we've talked about this a couple of times about presidential authority. Every president since the very beginning, George Washington included, have been testing the limits of presidential authority. But nobody has pushed the limits to how this president has done it. And again, I'm a legislative guy. I think the power belongs to the people. The people's biggest power is in the legislature, not in the executive branch, because the executive branch can play much more favors and completely ignore entire demographics. Well, you as me as your elected legislature guy and Congress and also the council represents smaller geographies and has to like listen to your smaller geography to make sure their voice is heard. And executive branch folks don't. They can just blow off people because they didn't vote for them, and it doesn't matter to them in the larger picture. But if your state legislatures or your congressperson is doing a good job, to make sure your voice is heard as part of the larger body. And if you're willing to surrender that voice to the executive branch, you're doing a disservice to the people where you work.
Get out and vote, folks. It's very important.
Yeah, the city council, speaking of votes, the council, I believe, has set the polling places. The polling places do change year by year. So definitely check the city council website. I'm sure Joe will have many interviews coming up with Nikki and other folks about this coming election. It is early ballots available, which I do not have the website right now, but the Secretary of State has streamlined this to a online process where you can ask for a ballot. Early voting, I believe, is the last 2 weeks. I think it's like August 23rd. I think that Saturday kicks off or Friday. And then obviously absentee ballots are available, as well as in-person voting as well. And a given fact that preliminary elections here are September 2nd, I'm expecting a super low turnout because it's the day after Labor Day. And then I hope people will get a mail-in ballot If they're not going to be here because, this can be the last real vacation during the first week of Labor Day for many people.
Yeah, clerk's predicting about an 18% turnout for the preliminary, so we'll see how that goes.
That's a You better get a lot of mail-in ballots to get to 18%, to be frank.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Because
more in the final, I'm sure, on November 4th.
yeah, I mean, Ward 6 has a preliminary, if I remember correctly, and then you have a large preliminary, and I think maybe a school committee preliminary.
No.
Oh, no, school committee. So it's basically Ward 6 and at large.
That's it. Yeah.
Oh, well, in that case, I mean, I live in Ward 5. I know there's only two candidates for Ward 5, so there's no preliminary, which means that I only get to vote for the reduction of at large. That's not that that is a hard drive when there's no ward race going on in the
Right.
preliminary. And I say the word preliminary, guys, as opposed to primary, because primary is a party, political party issue, not a nonpartisan election issue. So that's why we refer to it as preliminaries. I've heard people use the word primaries in local elections. Actually, incorrect term. That only applies when there's political parties involved.
That is correct. Very good, Tacky. A little civic lesson here today.
Definitions do matter
It
sometimes.
absolutely do, especially in the eyes of the law. Yes. So you said you're busy at work. What's going on?
Well, we got through our big party NCSL. Actually, Mayor Wu made an appearance for about a half hour greeting legislators around the country.
Yes, did you were you responsible for the surprise fireworks last night?
I was not. I did not plan the rest of the NCSL. Thankfully, I only had my little or large party of over 200 guests of Asian American officials and elected officials in our country to attend. And Mayor Wu and myself came to a realization at some point during the party that we've never seen this many Asian Americans elected in one place ever in our lives. As you guys know, there's seven right now elected Asian Americans in the State House, eight. Obviously, we have Nina, and believe it or not, Nota Bona is half Thai. People sometimes forget that, at the local level. But statewide, I mean, you can barely get to maybe a dozen people. You kind of throw in town meeting members, elected town meeting members, as well as some of the smaller boards and commissions in some towns. You probably get to maybe 20 if you're lucky. UMass Institute of Asian American Studies in the currents of getting a census of elected and appointed officials around the state, which is actually pretty hard when you think about it. This information is not easily available publicly. But we're not California or Hawaii, where there's large numbers of electeds of Asian electeds and Pacific Islanders up and down the ballot, whether it be a municipal, county, or state in Congress. It was really moving. Mayor Wu and myself, came new to this realization. We're looking at the crowd and was like, wow, I've never been around this many other electeds. They may not look exactly like me, but we shared a lot of common experiences on how we got elected and a lot of common experiences of how we treated in our states, not just politically, but also at the constituency level as well. And everyone's got a different story, but I mean, we're in 38 states that we have at least one Asian elected state legislator, in places like Wyoming and Utah, places never thought of that an Asian could get elected. And it's a reminder I like to say to everybody is that unlike the demographics, Asian and Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians, which mostly stay in Hawaii, obviously, can be elected everywhere. And obviously, the Hawaiian delegation is the largest because the entire legislature is Asian or Pacific Islander or Hawaiian. So that was a very moving weekend. Middle of the week, conferences began. I took a couple of meetings regarding some folks on right to repair, some folks regarding electronic transactions on credit cards. My committee oversees those two issues, which is much more complicated than the titles say. Those few words only reflect the beginning of a very complex situation. And Washington state legislators, I mean, offered state house tours to folks that only get to see us during NCSL. And the Washington delegation actually took me up for a state house tour. So I gave them the tacky tour to state house, and they were thrilled. Because if you live particularly in the West Coast, their state capitals are barely 120 years old. And excuse me, in places like Hawaii, I mean, their state capital was built in 1968.
Right. Yeah. That was the last state admitted to the Union, so that'd be the newest, yeah.
Yeah, well, our state capital is 1797. That's top three in age. And, I like to say I'm in the new part of building, which is 1895 or 1899, depending which guidebook you're looking at.
Modern section.
The modern section is 130 years old or whatever,
Right.
127 years old, depending on whose calendar we're using. So, Yeah, so I mean, we did a lot of that stuff. We're the host, so people have a problem, people have a question, people need to find something. You look for us. We're the hosts. Thankfully, we didn't have any major incidences. And also a chance to meet some and to catch up with some legislators or friends of mine, like Sharon Tamiko Santos from Washington State. I see every couple of years. She's been in the legislature 27 years in Washington State, and we talk about not just policy issues, but life issues and where we are. Things and which we we're the host. It's supposed to treat people good. I mean, that's part of being a host, good host. And then I was playing catch up with other people at social events. For example, the U.S. Constitution was the Massachusetts night on Tuesday. Went to the Black Latino Party Caucus Party on Tuesday night as well. Did some socializing, shaking hands, talking to people of different industries, and on top of trying to get the day part done. And then those elections of officers for the Asian caucus, all the sub caucuses, so to speak, had their own elections, which everyone had different kind of political drama. You think it's weird when you get local legislators from, try to grab legislators from like 38 states and jam them into a room and try to figure out how to run an election. I mean, in the case of some other states, it's all 50. So you can imagine the complexity and the politics involved.
Right. Yes. Where was this all at the convention center?
Yeah, the Oil Convention Center. So, and then I was catching up on a few folks what they've been hearing at the conference, and there's some very common themes. We can't trust the federal government. I've been saying this already, the federal government is no longer a reliable partner, and doesn't matter what state you're in, everybody's in the same boat. And I am actually kind of curious, does partisan politics get put aside at NCSO and NCSO leadership settles on a unified voice regarding how badly we're being treated by the federal government. I'm kind of curious if that's going to happen.
How will that work? Will there be a vote, or how will that work?
Yeah, there will be a vote. If there's interest of filing a resolution of the 50 states' collective voice, I'm not sure that's going to happen given how partisan life has become for all of us. But I mean, some of the particularly no income tax states have flat out said they're not raising revenue and they're just going to let the cut stand. And they're very aware they're going to lose a lot of people on human service benefits, especially Medicaid. They really just let them loose.
Interesting. I wonder if, I mean, New Hampshire is one of those states. I wonder if we'll see an influx from New Hampshire to Massachusetts.
You said what I just was thinking the other day talking to folks is that it's going to result a influx of out-of-state folks migrating to a state that has better human services that puts burden on those states' human services because they're going to realize, well, the cost of living is higher and unemployment is going up, which means jobs are available. The access to healthcare in particular, it doesn't matter where you're from, is crucial. And a lot of states, are particularly, like I said, tax states have no taxes are going to have are just going to cut people off. And particularly Medicaid, one of the loopholes that created inadvertently by the federal government was allowing states to tax hospitals and get that reimbursed by the federal government. So that oddly enough, the hospitals made whole and then the states are able to continue the programs. Well, that loophole is going to be slowly shrinking over the course of 3 years. So New Hampshire is a great example, no income tax state. So how to keep the Medicaid moving is to keep raising taxes against hospitals. And the hospital pays the taxes to the state, but the whole thing's Medicaid reimbursable, so they're able to keep the hospital whole again, which basically sounds like a kickback because that's what it is. But those loopholes are closing against states, and it hurts most states with no taxes. So, yeah, there are going to be people cut loose in different places. They're going to start migrating to other places. Like
That's what
some.
led to the demise of Quincy Hospital.
That's correct. Correct. And then you look at some states that are not part of the larger Medicaid expansion, like Texas. From their standpoint, it doesn't mean a whole lot. However, for example, research development for various technologies is a big problem for Texas because Texas is a huge technology state. Same as California, Massachusetts, and New Jersey, and now also North Carolina. They're becoming real high-tech states. And as the federal government starts getting tax credits and reducing the research funding on everything from new breakthroughs in biotechnology to chip manufacturing, there's going to be widespread impact on states. And while Texas, again, is a big state that can provide deficit spend like California, the vast majority of states, pretty much all 48 of us, can't deficit spend because there's not enough money.
Yeah, it's Massachusetts really will be hit twice, right? Technology and biotech.
That's right. And we also, obviously, because the immigration changes, it impacts our revenue on schools and it's going to impact tourism. For example, there's an additional $250 so-called integrity fee on all visas on top of the existing, I believe, 185 is the average visa price, which is going to impact visitors to Massachusetts and other states because that's going to eat into discretionary spending. Yeah, we all travel, we have a budget. And there's a $250 add-on per person, your family. As a result, you have to rearrange how you're going to spend your money. So one of the examples we can always use locally, for example, to put this in perspective, let's look at Fenway Park is always my favorite example. So whenever ticket prices go up or prices go up in the surrounding area on Fenway, people have to reconsider the budgets on a day trip to Fenway. And we're lucky to be local near Mass Transit to go to Fenway. If you're coming in from out of state, and it's actually not uncommon for people to come in from New Hampshire or Maine to come to Massachusetts to make a day of Fenway, let's say a family of four, and let's say ticket prices go up 25%, that does rearrange for a day trip coming down to Massachusetts to spend money in, let's say, local establishments for a day trip. Or maybe they decide not to use the parking areas near Fenway and decided to go even further out and take the MBTA. Price adjustments does affect how people enjoy recreation. And now imagine being a tourist, let's say from England, and you're spending $100, hundreds, actually thousands of dollars of your family of four, and you have to spend $185 plus another $250. And of course you have to get a hotel room, maybe Uber your way around as opposed to taking a car, a rental car. But now you're short minimum of $1,000 of extra spend that you could do in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and you pull that back and maybe dining out or enjoying a day trip somewhere. What I mean, a coworker here was grappling with the same thing. Do we get, they have three children. Do we get a separate room for the kids, or do we all kind of cram into one hotel room? So these are the things people are dealing with.
Yeah, this is real life issues that you and I deal with, and the federal government, is making difficult for other people who want to come into this country. And if you're a business worker, there's certain exemptions in the visa price increase. But if you're a border state, anybody that's along the Southwest, California, Texas, or border states, they do a lot of cross-border business. And people don't realize that a lot of traffic, particularly San Diego, passes back and forth of workers between Tijuana and San Diego. And until I visited San Diego, I didn't realize how much traffic there was. I actually went to the border to look and I realized, wow, that's a lot of cars. But it's not the only one. A lot of communities along the border of Texas and other places, either the employees on each, well, actually only the foreign side, not the state side, the border, needs to pay more, perhaps depending on type of visa. Well, the employer is going to have to eat that cost, perhaps. Not sure how that's going to work, but I know there's some exemptions, but it's not a big set of exemptions. So, the example of how it sounds small on paper because you're all thinking, oh, it's $250 a head. Yeah, well, think about how that is if you're a family of four coming to any state in the country for the purpose of recreation. And we love tourist dollars because they spend the money here and we don't have to do a lot for them because there's no infrastructure costs. Any kind you get time you get economic development of no infrastructure costs to this to your state or city or town is just gravy.
It's kind of like hitting the lottery. Yeah, it's just kind of like found money. It didn't cost you anything, so it's you get 100% of that as revenue.
Absolutely. So other things that the conference we're talking about the midterm elections, of course, a lot of uncertainty. We can talk about this more as we get closer to the fall, because we always love talking politics on the show. They talk about the impact on SNAP programs, food stamp programs. Some states are excess of 30% of the population on food stamp programs. If the state doesn't, again, have any money because they don't generate any money, they're going to just cut people off. As I like to say, I mean, there are such things as states themselves are welfare because they live off the federal government. Massachusetts, well, yes, we do take a lot of money for the government, federal government. We're not like 35% of our budget or 40 or 40, 50% of our budgets, depending on federal government, whether it be direct assistance or programs or a dependent on federal facilities and employees to keep up their economy. Virginia is actually the single biggest place where there's the most federal buildings and employees. So every time there's a employee cut by the federal government, those unemployment numbers are put on the Virginia tax rolls. I mean,
Oh, yes, sure.
Virginia unemployment rolls.
Absolutely, I get it. Yeah, I mean, yes. Although Massachusetts accepts grants, federal government grants, it also gives back in terms of what it produces in research and development.
Yeah, because it's an economic driver. And then on capital stuff, it's a matching grant. It's not 100% free money. So often the matching grants on infrastructure projects can range between 25% as high, sometimes low as 10% of the state has to provide the match. So, we passed a law last year to allow the governor to be able to use some of the interest from the Rainy Day Fund up to a certain amount to leverage against the grant programs and infrastructure programs the federal government had put out the last few years. Looks like this administration is going to suspend a lot of that money, which then, puts that effort to naught, unfortunately. Competition for federal grant money, believe it or not, somewhat contingent of whether or not you can pay your share. If you come up with your cut, you go up to the top of the list. And that's pretty important.
Yeah,
So
that was the deal with the funding for the Cape Cod bridges, as I recall.
yeah, we can come up with our share.
Right.
And you need the ability to, put money to do that. And of course, when you use federal tax dollars to do it, that's a shared cost of all taxpayers around the country, which actually reduces your burden because given the size of Massachusetts at 7 million people, probably about half plus are taxpayers. I'm assuming the other half is kids and senior citizens of Social Security. More than 50% of the state is taxpayers, like weighed against the whole country of, probably 130, 140 million working people. We make out.
That's right. We do. They're definitely lopsided there for smaller states. Rhode Island's even better.
Exactly. I mean, you have to look at how I perceive tax redistribution, because from my standpoint, whether it be at the local level, the state level, or at the federal level, the more we draw out, because it's a shared cost of all taxpayers, the more we draw out, the disproportional benefit actually works to our benefit. Firstly, there is a drawdown. For example, states that require higher Medicaid usage, higher food stamp usage, higher housing assistance, and all kinds of other federal programs draws against us in Massachusetts that has lower needs because we're actually a higher cost state of living. And the state itself has a lot of programs that actually either are better or duplicate federal programs. So, then that's the other direction where our tax dollars are not benefiting us directly because it's going the other way to benefit states that have minimal or no taxes. That have a lower cost of living, but also low economic development. And as a result, they become much more dependent on federal programs.
Right.
So again, this is kind of how I see the world in terms of tax redistribution. It moves both directions. And depending who we are, in terms of like what state are, meaning who we are is like what state we are, you build a strategy around how, your federal programs and your federal grants to try to get as much dollars back into your state, on the income tax level. And even though some of it's bonded by the federal government, it's still paid by income taxes at the end.
I think,
So, that's how we think.
yeah, for formulating the next fiscal year's budget here in Massachusetts is going to be a daunting challenge, I think.
This administration, Healey administration, is still looking for cutting measures inside their own administration, as you guys are aware. We actually went under the governor's budget by over 1% from her original recommendation. The governor also vetoed another about $120 million. There's still pending overrides in the legislature where we're not sure what we're going to do yet. Plus, there's a whole lot of cuts, as we talked about, Medicaid. While we're not, like a southern state or a high senior population state like Florida and Arizona, there's a lot of senior citizens there that are under a Medicare program, where we are not that size, but it's still significant. And then, like housing, for example, right? I mean, I got word they're going after perhaps seriously reducing or cutting or eliminating support housing programs for low and middle income people. So lower income and low income people, you need help on housing assistance, and a lot of those programs may go away. And what's disturbing as well is we got word from the Department of Unemployment Assistance, DUA, which is going up. I have 10 pending cases now regarding the DUA right now, which is a lot, by the way, for us in Quincy, my little section of Quincy. They're closing the call center on Friday because intake is so high. They need to move those call center help people to help with intake to help quickly adjudicate cases that are pending decisions at DOA. That's how bad it's gotten on the load coming in, but also hiring freeze, and those employees are paid by the federal government, not paid by the state government. The hiring freeze at state level plus reduction of federal funds is going to impact your services on federal programs that we administer. Unemployment is one of the big ones.
Yeah, again, it's going to be a difficult budget season, I think, going forward. Speaking of housing, I read this week about the plans to use some surplus state-owned property for new housing development.
Yeah, that's not a new idea. Obviously, the state is doesn't have to answer to cities and towns regarding local zoning, but we do comply with zoning because we control the building code and we should follow our own codes. But it becomes a local political problem for legislators and municipal officials that don't want to have additional housing. So while the state wants to do it, again, we talked about earlier about advocating for your communities, that's where your resistance is going to come from. And that's one of the bigger barriers, whether or not the executive branch is going to worry about people's local politics. You saw that with the MBTA communities ready. And also, let's talk about that a little bit. When you build new housing, of course, Quincy's building a lot of new housing. There's an infrastructure cost, right? Road costs, sewer, water, electric, gas. That's a cost. And then you also have to consider whether or not there's families in the new housing, which means there's additional cost to the school system. Right. And depending on how many units are built and where they're built, you obviously want their pub our public safety, especially fire departments, able to reach these locations quickly and have the best equipment possible. So while it's good to have development, there is a cost associated with that development coming in, depending on whom goes into those units.
Right, and what services they might need exactly from that municipality.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And Quincy is a big city with a budget of what, $480 million. And fairly good overall infrastructure and good schools, which for all the cities in the state, we're actually, I think we're in very good shape comparatively speaking to other cities. But if you're a smaller community where you have a much smaller tax base, let's say you're under 20,000 people, influx of, let's say, 300 people coming to your community could, and they all have children, for example, could have a massive impact on your school system.
For sure. Yeah, it's basically creating an entire new neighborhood for sure.
Yeah, in smaller communities.
Right.
So, it's kind of one of those chicken egg things where people want, more property tax dollars because that's how municipalities are predominantly funded. But there's also this additional cost depending on, whom comes into your new housing and what other infrastructure costs are they going to be needing to use depending on the circumstances of how to come into your community.
Yeah. It's August 7th. Today we're recording this, and all the new tariffs are now in effect.
I say this over and over again, given the uncertainty and all the fluctuating numbers and, ships in the sea, in the ocean coming over now when they come to Massachusetts, I'm sorry, Mass. Well, actually, we do. We actually get cars and other things in Massachusetts.
Oh yeah, blow down a Black Falcon terminal, you'll see them. Yeah.
I shouldn't say not us. We are a big shipping port. I keep forgetting that sometimes. It's not just New York and LA.
Or I guess it's the Ed Flynn terminal now, but whatever, yeah.
Whatever. So as a result, people are gonna at some point have the cost passed along. P&G, Procter and Gamble already announced 5% increase in all their products. And you guys know Procter and Gamble, you may not realize it, but I mean a lot of your cleaning products, for example, and toothpaste and such, come out of P&G. And that's a direct cost pass to the consumer because at some point, they can eat so much of that stuff in their earnings, meaning the profits. But at some point, it gets to, if you start moving to balance zero profits, then you're kind of losing. As I like to say, you always want to have extra because of, rainy day. You don't want to come up dead even on both sides. You always want to come up ahead because that money can be used in case things go bad later, right?
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, they're clearly indicating that, what they're looking for, safety margin of profit for future use. Is definitely going to be impacted by tariffs. And then you got other situations where you may not realize. So, for example, mangoes, not just come from South America, but they're actually a huge Indian export during the high season, receive a lot of mangoes, mostly in the western part of the country. and 50% tariffs on agriculture is going to be a real impact. And there's also the moving target, right? The president's using tariffs, and now sanctions on Russia are coming up, perhaps, countries that do business with Russia. Now you have these so-called agreements in place, or these, in case of China, kind of like a status quo situation. Does that disrupt the existing negotiations? It's again, I mean, do you guys want to try to cut a deal where the individual is kind of making a moving target of what the deal looks like?
It's uncertain. Business hates uncertainty, and so does Wall Street. So
Well, so
everybody's it's kind of status quo, yeah.
constituents hate uncertainty.
That too, yes.
People like to have certainty as a matter of the fact that you got to plan your life out. And so the tariffs won't really be really felt heavily until we get to the next round of inventory that has to come into the country. So, I mean, for example, Japan is 15%. We talk about Vietnam, which makes a lot of shoes and clothing, like a lot of shoes coming to Vietnam. I just bought a new pair of sneakers now. It was $60 a sneaker from Reebok, a pair. And that wasn't too different what I paid last year. I mean, a couple of bucks up, but not a big differential because I buy actually an older pair that I like, an older brand, not the newest models. But those new sneakers won't get here till maybe October.
Right, and they'll be priced higher, yeah.
They'll be priced higher then. That's why, the administration, and I get it, with spin doctors, blah, blah, blah. I get it. Trying to make the present day, like, oh, nothing's happening now because we just implemented these tariffs and, your prices are fine. Well, that's just now.
Yeah, don't look over here, look over here. Yeah.
Correct. And that's just the inventory that's burning out now.
Right.
The future inventory is a real question mark. And while there's essentially 8-ish countries that have a deal, and of which only three are really major economies. I mean, the EU, and even then, each individual country in the EU may cut a separate deal. And in Korea, you still have Mexico and Canada as your big trading partners, as well as China and India, which is a big economic country now, as well as Brazil, which is, he hates Brazil. So, and the governor, and I'm sorry, the president is trying to influence foreign policy through tariffs because he wants to demonstrate that, he is, somehow running the planet, and it's not going to work. People are not going to like release prisoners because he says so. I mean, they are not going to risk their autonomy and their sovereignty for the US president. And I think people, need to understand that. And this actually will create burdens for US businesses and foreign and business, US business investment overseas. It's not just about investment to the US. It actually created another funky thing I've noticed. This really funky situation is created is that we can be bought off.
Interesting. Yeah.
So it's like, all right, well, the Japanese is a classic example. The Japanese want to maintain the tariffs against US cars. The president claimed that US car manufacturers want to go to Japan. I kind of have a lot of questions about that, but besides the point. And at the end of the day, they gave $550 billion, which I'm not sure how that is really a solid number, but whatever. In exchange of not having a reduction of tariff against U.S. cars coming to to Japan, which prohibits cost prohibitive for U.S. Manufacturers to build a plant in Japan to sell cars there. So they essentially he sold out the car industry. That's what he did in exchange for financial investments, which honestly, as much as oh, we can make them pay for anything. No, that's not how that works. I mean, when the other side's holding the purse strings, it's they actually have a say, a bit more say than people give it credit for how their money is. It's like they just dropped the US government $550 in one giant check in here. That's not how this is going to work. Because it's going to be based on a combination of bonds and foreign investment. And it's not like it's people have this like false impression because he likes to get impression people to roll him a giant check. That isn't how this works in real life. So, I mean, every country started doing that. Korea did the same thing. Korea, South Korea did a basic buyout. The EU did something similar, although it's a little bit of a moving target because of the nature of how the EU operates. So people have figured out they can get a tariff reduction to about 15% and just basically, give a promise of a payout. This is a horrible way to do business, by the way.
It reminds me of the loan shark, basically.
Well, it also doesn't guarantee, foreign investment development actually creates more jobs here. And it's not that simple, because they make it sound like there's writing checks to the United States Treasury. No, that's not what's going on. They're under some misconception that, all these things are going to create new manufacturing in the US. That's not happening either. I mean, this money is considered foreign investment in the US, and I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work, but it's still got to be economically profitable for, if it's a private company, to invest in the US, right? Why would you, anybody, if you tell me you're going to put money in as an investment and take negative return, then you really should turn off this video now.
You won't be in business very long.
You won't be around very long, so you're being government benefits faster than anybody if you think that way.
That's right.
And
Well,
then,
yeah,
yeah, and
it's why the Fed held strong on interest rates right now. They just don't know.
they don't know, but I mean, the job revision numbers will probably start to stimulate an idea they're going to probably reduce rates just a hair, to try to see if they can fall off a greater number reduction. We've been talking about this for months now. The numbers are not matching up with the economy. I mean, there's like over $1.2 trillion in credit card debt. We're back to the highest credit card debt among people since last year. There actually been a somewhat reduction. Now it's just spiked again.
Yeah, and so are defaults on mortgages. Yeah.
And car loans. Car loans
Yeah,
is
the
the
car
first
loans.
thing
Yeah.
for. And why do I say car loans? It's because if you had to pay for your home versus paying for your car and debt, you're paying the mortgage on your home before you're paying your debt on your car.
Sure. Yeah.
So the two places you want to look is car loan and student loans before you get to mortgages. If there's a spike in car loan defaults and a spike in student loan defaults, the question is how long does that go until that same individual is going to default on their mortgage?
Right, exactly, because that's where they're putting their money right now, because that's their priority, obviously, shelter.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And then, we'll see how that plays out. The macro data, again, it's macro data. It's hard to interpret it sometimes in your own, dining room table as you're doing the math on your own checkbooks. Although not everything's on a computer, but whatever. You're doing it on your phone. But I mean, it's going to be very complicated, I think, for people moving forward. In terms of how to manage the cost of living. And unable to anticipate what the cost of rising living may come up. And in macro data world, I mean, if you're the Fed Reserve or the president or anybody, and the macro data researchers, you want to see what offsets are. So if energy prices drop significantly, it can offset some of the increased costs on, let's say, produce from other countries that have been jacked up between 10 and 50%.
Yeah.
And it was just a bakery. I'll use the bakery example over and over again. Madagascar vanilla is probably a vast majority, actually probably over 75 to 90% of our vanilla comes from one place. But a country that's so poor they can't afford to buy our sneakers, even if it's made in Vietnam. It's what, like 40%, 38%, whatever. That affects your local bakery more than anything else.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned that. I've noticed the baked goods in particular are very, very expensive. It's a combination of things. I'm sure that's one of them. The egg crisis, probably another one as well.
Yeah, and dairy a bit. I mean, we get a lot of dairy from Canada, although we're never hit our quota on milk going the other way because they have a surplus of milk. But we get a lot of dairy from there, and then we do get a lot of grains from all over the world. In addition to our shipping a lot of grains out over the world, and of course labor cost.
Right, exactly.
We still have a weird kind of labor shortage in certain sectors. Despite the fact unemployment is up. As I talked earlier, I got a ton of 10 pending unemployment cases. That was in the last 10 days. And
Yeah,
that's
what's going on with that? Is there a problem with the check issuing or what's going on?
processing.
Oh, processing. Okay.
Yeah, because they got a what part of unemployment is to actually confirm with the employee that you've been unemployed by the employer.
Yep.
And the employer actually has the ability to contest whether or not you should get an employment. And then you appeal the decision, appeal against your employer about being denied unemployment.
Okay, so that process is taking time.
That process takes time. It's not a snap decision. And since unemployment's gone up quite significantly, it's actually a higher workload that needs to be done.
Gotcha.
Also,
Okay.
confirmation of who you are, because during COVID, if you may remember, and you probably may have been a victim listening to this, someone stole your identity to get unemployment illegally during COVID. It was one of the biggest things that none of us could have anticipated.
Yes.
And if you were a victim of identity theft on unemployment, unemployment needs some more documents to confirm your identity because someone stole your identity. So,
Yes, happened personally. I was able to stop it before any checks got issued, but yes.
yeah, you felt that personally. And this is a real modern thing that none of us experienced before COVID. And we're still gripping with it because obviously you are listening. One, would like to get your employment benefits if you're listening. But two, you don't want someone stealing someone's unemployment benefits because
No,
that
but
hurts you.
that's right. If you need it, you need it to be there when you need it. Yeah.
Yeah, and someone stealing, it hurts somebody else,
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
right? It
Wow.
drains the pool. So, it's a lot more complicated than it was pre-COVID on how unemployment works. And unfortunately, our constituencies are suffering from the delay.
What's going on in the district, Techie?
It's pretty quiet right now.
Yeah.
There's a CADI post memorial tomorrow, actually on Friday. Is today Thursday? Yeah, today's Thursday.
Yes.
Yeah, tomorrow. And then August Moon Festival is already on the 17th, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. in front of the Quincy High School. So plan your traffic route accordingly. Basically, essentially, most of the morning to the late afternoon around the high school and Cardin Street. But it's going to be another great festival. Let's hope I don't cook. Congratulations to Eagle Scouts. I don't want to get into people's individual names, but there's an Eagle Scout ceremony coming up in Troop 6. So congratulations to those folks. And our sales tax weekend holiday is this weekend, the 9th and the 10th. So I do expect to see a spike, and that does cost us money because we lose sales tax dollars. I'm not sure what the final count be because it's going to be very challenging regarding consumers regarding how much they can afford. But it's back to school stuff, obviously, is the big selling point for this weekend. I'm hoping the stores get some kind of a bump this weekend, despite the loss of tax dollars.
Yeah, I think you'll see a lot of TVs and computers, stuff like that.
Yep. And right now in Boston, it's been moving month. I've noticed traffic has been kind of crazy in Boston this week as people move in. But also, when students come, those that bring their families stick around to spend money in Massachusetts. So it looks like there is still tourism going on because you can actually hear a variety of languages. And in the State House, you see people with little tour books that are in different languages walking around the State House.
That's neat. Yeah.
Yeah, I do love it when people visit the building. I think it's, a great place to walk the halls of John Hancock, John Adams, JFK, and MLK. So, hopefully that will continue. Obviously, it'll slow down in September. And I do think people are probably going to travel, but I'm very curious how travel numbers are going to look this month as people try to get in one last vacation. And I'm not sure how it's going to play out. Again,
Right.
some of the big data is kind of starting to move the direction I think they should be moving in, but we're a far cry from far cry from actually having some solid numbers saying the
Yeah, yeah.
direction we're going in.
Yeah, well, we'll keep talking about it here for sure. Speaking of Caddy Day, it's a little different this year. It's at Mount Walston Cemetery at the World War II Memorial, instead of over at Caddy Park.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a little bit of change. I've gotten used to go to Caddy Park. Generally, that event's normally in the fall.
Correct. Yeah, I don't know why it's in August this year, but that's what it's yeah, August 8th, 10:30 in the morning at the World War II Memorial.
So that's Justin Marymount Park on off of Hancock Street.
Right.
Well, actually, no, it's the Doughboy at the very end. They're going to do it at the Doughboy.
No, World War II Memorial at Mount
Oh,
Walston
okay.
Cemetery.
Oh, sorry. That's good. We have to go to World War II Cemetery. Oh, that's not bad. Kind of curious why doing it there. I always
I
like
don't
it.
know.
Yeah, I like it, Caddy Park. Because the memorial's there. Whatever. I don't make these decisions. I just go.
That's it. Exactly. Okay, this is the time for you to tell us how to get a hold of you.
Well, we're in room 42 of the State House. Definitely please make a visit. It's quieter now, but still busy as I got a process. Actually, I have to get off this call, I get on the office call because I got to get another set of bills out by mid-August out of committee under a deadline system. So we are still working room 42, 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370 is our number, tacky.chan, tacky.chan at mahouse.gov. I'm getting inundated with emails given the last federal situation, which I'm not the federal government people. Reach out to Congressman Lynch and Senator Markey and Senator Warren. But it's interesting how that works. MALegislature.gov, MALegislature.gov. Again, I strongly encourage people, please set up an account. We can watch bills progress, watch our hearings, watch our sessions, and you can monitor how things are going on things that you are interested in is going in the legislature. TackyChin.org is our resource page. It's also a contact page. People actually do use it because they get contacts through there. State Representative Tacky Chan, Facebook, but also Instagram now. We are moving off of X because there is such low volume. So we're going to be an Instagram user and we're gradually migrating. And of course, we're Joe with QATV once or twice a week, but we are hitting vacation month, Joe. So I think we might be having a little bit more of a longer lapse than we normally do.
I'll be around next week and the week after, but then not the week after that.
Yeah, I think we're actually on the same schedule. So I think we can very much schedule for next week would be the week of the 10th. And then next week is the week of 17th. That's the August Moonma day. So then we'll probably get two more shows in before
Yep.
the break.
I think so. Sounds good. Maybe I'll have a tan by then.
Have the glow. For those in audio land, we'll miss the glow.
That's right. Thanks a lot, Tacky.
Angel, see you soon.